Hi, I'm Kim Masters. Thanks for listening to The Business. Some of the most entertaining stories produced today aren't just on the big screen. They can be heard on KCRW's Unfictional. Intimate tales and artful documentaries crafted by some of the most talented radio producers across the globe. Check it out. You can find Unfictional on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You weren't in it for the money, you weren't in it for the recognition, and you weren't always in it because it was fun. But I think being around his creativity was incredibly intoxicating for people.
Filmmaking giant Orson Welles had no problem attracting talent to the problem-plagued film that he was working on when he died in 1985. Author Josh Karp tells us why The Other Side of the Wind remains unfinished and unseen to this day. Then, California lawmakers hope they've figured a way to keep Hollywood productions in California. We'll see how that's going. But first on the news banter, TLC lands in 19 kinds of hot water and counting. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my banter buddy, Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Hello, Mike.
Hey, Kim.
Most of our listeners probably are aware, I guess, if they've never seen 19 Kids and Counting, which I have to admit I never have, that there is a big scandal, and this is a TLC show. One of the 19 kids has been publicly revealed as a teen. He's in his late 20s now. Had molested a number of young women, including his siblings, among others of the 19 kids. This is something that the family knew about. The family's whole shtick is that they are, you know, a conservative family values thing. This is a little bit off message. TLC has pulled the show. As we are recording, though, they have not yet canceled it.
Yeah, this is really, really an ugly story for the most part. But the problem with TLC is that 19 Kids and Counting is one of their hottest shows, more than 3 million viewers a week most weeks. So what do you do? So they've temporarily pulled it off, like you said. But long term, is this a show that's going to hurt their brand?
Can I just say yes?
Yeah. But you know, we think of TLC and we think of some of the real freak show stuff they've done in the past couple of years. They're trying to move away from that, but they want to go more in the direction of family. And this was one of their premier shows that was going to help them move in that direction. Direction, now not so much.
Of course, they also had the problem with Here Comes Honey Boo Boo and the Mama June character was dating a convicted sex offender.
Right,
so,
right.
Yeah, and big ick factor.
And if you go further back, they obviously had the controversy with John and Kate Plus 8, which turned into a disaster.
Right,
so TLC is very familiar with shows that blow up in their face and they have to figure out what to do next. So we'll wait and see.
Advertisers are bailing and that's where the money comes from. So if advertisers won't come in, that is going to kind of be the death knell for this thing. But it's become a political issue because there are people like Mike Huckabee, one of our many Republican presidential candidates, who is saying, youthful mistake, he's apologized, can't we move on? At the same time, there are people on the other side looking at the mom in this family who knew about what had happened in her own family, who had gone publicly saying that transgender people are likely to be sexual predators, which has not played well with a whole bunch of people.
Right. Hypocrisy, obviously, is always a big topic in politics, and this is a great example of, you know, Josh Duggar, the man who's accused of this molestation, was part of the Family Research Council, which talks a lot about the culture wars and how the coarsening of American culture, partly because of pop culture and television, and look what just happened.
And, you know, one of the other things I wonder about is it seems that this is something that was known at Oprah Winfrey's company back years ago already, and people starting to ask, what did TLC know and when did they know it? And I don't know if anybody's going to pursue that, but it certainly is a relevant question.
They knew that they were running a show that got 3 million viewers a week,
yeah,
and a lot of advertising
dollars.
That's
all they wanted to know, yeah. Sad but true. Meanwhile, elsewhere in TV, ITV, this is a British television company that's been buying a lot of stuff. They were going to buy the Weinstein Company. And the Weinstein Company, you know, I remember I myself put a microphone in Harvey Weinstein's face. We were doing an interview years ago when his company, then called Miramax, was part of Disney. And he said, if Disney fires us, we will celebrate. And guess what? Disney fired them. And I don't think it's been quite so easy for them ever since. Money is very hard to find. But this deal, this ITV deal, was for TV stuff, which is not what the Weinstein Company is known for. And people didn't get it from the jump.
Not what they're known for. And they don't really have a television library to back it up.
They have Project Runway and they have Marco Polo on Netflix. But it's not, like, you don't think Harvey Weinstein TV.
It's not teeming with the kind of properties that would justify the kind of dollars that ITV wanted to spend.
Yeah, I mean, we heard from, you know, I talked to people who looked at the deal and said they just were, nobody got it from the beginning, and now it's fallen apart. The question, of course, is what is going to happen with the Weinstein Company, because I think they really wanted the money and they're not going to get it. And we're in a place now in the industry where a lot of people who are a little bit sort of on the bubble, as you would say in TV, you know, they always seem to pull a rabbit out of their hat. We see it with Ryan Kavanaugh at his company Relativity. We see it with Harvey. And, you know, the rabbits seem to be getting a little scarce right now.
Right. There was a gold rush, especially in television, like you mentioned a couple of years ago, where these European companies were coming over and just buying up anything that breathed. And there was a period of time where people were making a lot of stupid money. A lot of other companies, by the way, that didn't have much library or didn't own their own shows, where we're making ridiculous deals because they could. But I think that's drying up right now.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens there. Speaking of, you know, sources of revenue for TV that dry up, the networks have really been moving towards for some time now. It used to be not legal, but now they can produce the shows that they put on their air. You know, as there's been more competition, it seemed less important to force networks to not own all the shows that they run on their air. But now the rules are over. And the Wall Street Journal just ran an interesting story sort of quantifying the degree of this shift. In the fall season, ABC will own or have a stake in almost 70% of coming shows, where as opposed to what was not quite 60% last year and not even 50% in 2010. Same thing at Fox. I mean, you will see shows canceled that may perform better than shows that are renewed because guess what? The studio has another way to make money when they own the show.
Yeah, and network execs are being much more honest about that than they used to be. On our podcast, The Spinoff, we had two executives from ABC and CBS basically admitting that when everything's equal, they're going to go with the co-owned property because not only do you have control of the long tail where the show ends up, but that's where you're making your money now. You're not making your money on repeats anymore because there are no repeats.
Barely any.
So, and, you know, the license fees are small enough that the real money, of course, is in syndication and in international.
Yeah, when you have a hit, as we've seen with Seinfeld, you know, Hulu paid, what, about $700,000 per episode. And it's not like Seinfeld hasn't been rerun all over the place, and it's still worth that much money in this environment.
Yeah, and it's also important to hold on to your branding. So if you have a show like Mindy Project, for example, which was on Fox, but it was owned by NBC, once Mindy Project went off Fox, Fox didn't have any sort of branding rights anymore. Now that more people are watching these shows on other platforms, if you don't own that show, you no longer have any rights to it.
Yeah, and you no longer get to sort of shape the perception of Fox as a place that runs a thing like the Mindy Project. Ironically, of course, the Mindy Project is now going to be gone from Fox.
And will be a Hulu show.
And will be a Hulu show, but that's a separate story. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Kim.
That's Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Orson Welles was only 25 years old when he had the greatest success of his career, co-writing, directing, and starring in Citizen Kane.
On the other hand, I am the publisher of The Enquirer.
As such, it's my duty, and I'll let you in on a little secret. It's also my pleasure to see to it that decent, hardworking people in this community aren't robbed blind by a pack of money-mad pirates just because they haven't anybody to look after their interests.
In the years to follow, Welles could have used someone to help look after his interests. The filmmaker may have been a genius, but he was terrible with money and had poor luck with his producing partners. Frequently broke, Welles did commercials and voiceovers to keep himself and his projects afloat. As is revealed in this argument, recorded nearly 30 years after the release of Citizen Kane, the auteur-director sometimes found the work to be frustrating.
That's like he's wanting me to emphasize in before July. Come on, fellas, you're losing your heads. I wouldn't direct any living actor like this in Shakespeare.
Will you do this? It's impossible.
Orson, you did six last year, and by far and away the best, and I know the reason.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving it.
That was Welles in 1970, the same year he started making The Other Side of the Wind. After having lived abroad for more than a decade, Welles had returned to America to make a comeback film about a director making a comeback film. John Huston played Jake Hannaford, a character who bore more than a passing resemblance to Welles himself. The Welles shot plenty of footage. The project was still unfinished when he died 15 years later. Our guest, author Josh Karp, has written a new book about what went wrong in the making of The Other Side of the Wind.
Him kind of, you know, deciding he couldn't function within the studio system, it made him one of the first real independent filmmakers, but it also caused him a world of trouble because he needed somebody like John Houseman, who'd been his original partner, who understood him and kind of made a world where everything was taken care of except for him having to come in and be Orson Welles. He and Houseman were kind of destined to fall apart, and they did after Kane. And after that, you know, he never really found that person who could make all that stuff happen for him.
He became sort of hung up, I think, on issues of Final Cut.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he obviously had Final Cut with Kane, which was unprecedented. And then after that, as time went on, it became more and more and more important to him to have this total control. So, I mean, he was really, you know, he's an incredibly creative guy. And the creativity, I think, was what mattered to him more than anything, which may not have been what mattered to people who were trying to make money.
I suppose the model that came to exist didn't really exist at that time to do things as independently. And then, as you say, he had terrible taste in partners.
You know, it occurred to me about halfway through the book that the scenario of him having an impossible time raising money, it's almost, you know, it's inconceivable that somebody of his talent, no matter how difficult, would be in that situation in today's Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if he made, you know, this epically great Citizen Kane-like movie, people would attach themselves to him who would kind of make things work for him.
So maybe Welles would have been maybe better off today, but maybe not. At the time, he started making this The Other Side of the Wind, this comeback film, I guess, about
yes.
a comeback film. He didn't really even have a script for the film. It was like a mockumentary in a way.
Well, he had a script. His idea was he'd been working on the script for at least 12 and possibly 15 years.
Oh.
It was an idea that he started working on in the mid or late 50s. And originally the main character, the director, was a novelist kind of based on Hemingway, who had lost his creative powers and was being kind of trailed around by, you know, the academics who were telling him what a genius he is.
And had a very, you know, conflict-laden relationship with Orson Welles.
Yes. The film itself takes place during a single day, and it's July 2nd, which is the day Hemingway killed himself.
Right. So the character could be Hemingway plus Welles, but a lot of people are going to see Welles as that character
right.
if this movie ever gets finished.
Right. And so so with the script, I mean, he wrote the script, I mean, almost compulsively. But what he wanted to do was have this giant script, show it to the people who are going to be in the film, and then have them improvise based on the idea of their character and where he told them they were in the story.
He was proto Larry David or something.
Yeah, right. No, I mean, everything about it, it was super ambitious on like about every level. It was two films. It was the film within the film, which is being made by Hannaford. And it is this, his attempt at like kind of a Michelangelo Antonioni comeback movie. Okay, so it's just kind of this weird, symbolic, beautifully photographed, but not necessarily having any meaning, as if an old studio guy was making that film.
Right.
And then the storyline is carried by this kind of mockumentary documentary about this birthday party for Hannaford, who is being chased all over the place by people with cameras, you know, screaming, Mr. Hannaford, Mr. Hannaford, and asking him all these asinine cineast questions. And one of the things that is great about it is he cast people from his own life, playing themselves in many cases, and playing out their own relationships with Welles. So, for instance, on the first day of shooting, Peter Bogdanovich, who at the time had directed Targets, but not yet Last Picture Show, was playing a guy who was writing an as-told-to book with Hannaford, which is what Bogdanovich was doing at the time. And Joe McBride, who was writing a book about Welles, Welles met him like 2 days before, and he cast him as another guy who's writing a book about Hannaford.
It sounds incredibly, like, impulsive, undisciplined, unstructured, and yet all of these people were so devoted to him. Frank Marshall, I think, who's, of course, the producer of many films, including this upcoming Jurassic World, he coined a term, I don't know if you say Vistow, volunteers in service to Orson Welles. All these people would do right. anything.
I mean, he really was such a compelling figure, I think, for people to be around. Les Moonves, who's head of CBS, at one point, you know, Showtime was trying to finish it, and somebody came to him and said, you know, we need to talk about this thing called The Other Side of the Wind. It's an Orson Welles movie. You know, I'm sure you've never heard of it. And he said, heard of it. I'm in it. Right.
Because he started as an actor. Right.
He was there for like 2 days. Right. Because everybody was an extra. Cameron Crowe was an extra. All these people were there. And I think being around Orson Welles on several different levels was really an incredible experience. I mean, you know, people, I think at the purest level, kind of looked at it like, okay, Orson Welles is making a movie. That is important. It's important to be around this. It's important to witness this. You know, you weren't in it for the money. You weren't in it for the recognition. And you weren't always in it because it was fun. But I think being around his creativity and being around his genius, for lack of a better word, was incredibly intoxicating for people.
Clearly. I mean, it's kind of funny that he could get the talent, but he couldn't get the money. So, you know, there's somehow the business people were not as intoxicated, I guess.
It's interesting. He was a guy who was capable of earning like $15,000 a day in 1970 doing voiceover work or working on somebody's film. But he always was on the run financially. He never had extra money laying around. And he put his money into his own productions, which is like the antithesis, right, of how you make money in Hollywood.
Go for other people's money, OPM. Right. That's the motto of Hollywood, yeah. So he thought he had found someone in the sister of the Shah of Iran's husband, right?
Yeah, it was the Shah had a really, and I think she's still alive, like a really tough twin sister. And this was her estranged husband who had managed to remain in the good graces of the Shah, but was not, you know, a great follower of the Shah. I mean, he was a very cultured, very intelligent, very good guy. I mean, it always seemed so ominous that he was the Shah's brother-in-law. And they were using some government money to fund this picture, but he was incredibly patient with Welles and incredibly patient in giving him more and more money. But eventually, there came a point where things got tough in Iran.
The Shah was overthrown, of course.
Yeah, I mean, and even before the overthrow, I mean, there was kind of the rumblings of the overthrow, at which point, you know, the people who were in power in Iran started saying things like, you know, we've been working on this movie with Orson Welles for 6 years. Why don't we check into why that's not done? And anytime Welles got that kind of pushback, I think, it just made him scurry for the hills. So it triggered all of his issues about control and about Final Cut and things like that. So the tougher things got in Iran and the more pressure that was on the Shah's brother-in-law, this movie that had been in production for 6 years just got completely cursed because Welles could not respond positively to people putting pressure on him.
And then, of course, the Ayatollah Khomeini takes over all the assets, and including the film, right?
Well, kind of. That was one of the great myths going into this was, you know, well, the Ayatollah had the film. But what happened was the Ayatollah's guys went to France after the overthrow to look for the film and to look at the interest that they had in Paris. And they showed up at the production office. There was a woman named Françoise Widhoff who was running the company at the time. And she said they were the most polite guys in the world, but they were poking around. And she had received a tax bill that was a mistake from the French government. And it was like 20 times what they owed. And it was a huge amount of money. And she had resolved it, but she still had the bill. And so when these guys came to see her, she said, you know what? You guys can take everything, but I just want to give you this because this is yours too. And she handed them this huge tax bill and they said, okay, bye.
So they didn't have the film.
Yeah, they did not take the film. The film wound up in a complicated dispute between Welles and his financiers, wound up essentially getting impounded in the lab under an injunction by the French government. And the way in which the French law worked, and I'm going to mangle the French, there's this French copyright concept of droit d'auteur, mm-hmm. which is the rights of, you know, the right
author,
of the author.
Right? Mm-hmm.
And so Welles always owned the moral right to his work. So they were tied to him and they had the money in it. So he was tied to them. And the longer things went on, the tenser things got. And there were injunctions and motions and counter motions. And it's like a whole
right.
legal seminar as to what happened.
Coming up after a short break, money problems continue to haunt the other side of the wind. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Josh Karp, author of a new book about Orson Welles' last movie. After Welles died in 1985, the rights to that film, The Other Side of the Wind, eventually wound up with his former mistress, Oya Kodar, and his daughter, Beatrice. The Shah of Iran's brother-in-law also retained some rights along with the film's French-Iranian production company. After a lot of wrangling, the battle over those rights was finally resolved. And this year, on what would have been Welles' 100th birthday, a group of filmmakers, including Frank Marshall and Peter Bogdanovich, still haven't given up the ghost. They've launched a crowdfunding campaign in hopes of finishing the film.
You think with the idea that, you know, this is kind of how Welles would have done it if he was alive today. You know, Wes Anderson has made videos supporting it, Noah Baumbach, Brett Ratner. Several people, and I think it's been a tough slog to try to raise that money, but that's where things are at right now.
I mean, it's a couple million dollars, so some of the names you've mentioned I think could potentially find that money in their sofa cushions, but I guess they, unlike Orson Welles, have figured out that you use other people's money when you are doing movies.
Right, and it's occurred to me that, you know, if everybody gave $25,000 or if everybody gave, you know, $50,000, this could have gotten done a lot more quickly, but yeah, I really hope they get the movie done because I think they're doing it for the reasons people worked for Welles, which is because they're like, this isn't a Welles film and this is an important thing to do. But, you know, it comes right back to the ending of everything, which is that it's a money problem for an Orson Welles film.
Josh Karp is the author of Orson Welles' last movie, The Making of the Other Side of the Wind. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So far, the Indiegogo campaign producers have raised only about $230,000, just over 10% of their target. They're still hoping to meet their $2 million goal by mid-June. $50 contributors might get a DVD of The Other Side of the Wind if it's ever finished. For $7,500, you get dinner with Frank Marshall and Peter Bogdanovich. For years, the Los Angeles film and television community has bemoaned runaway production, studios shooting projects in other states or overseas to take advantage of production incentives. California has responded by expanding its own film and television incentive program. KCRW's Saul Gonzalez sought out some of the people affected by this tax deal and brings us this story.
The newest big-budget summer movie to hit theaters is called San Andreas, and it has a very California storyline. Super strong earthquakes strike the Golden State, destroying both L.A. and San Francisco.
The earth will literally crack open, and you will feel it on the East Coast.
Now, California may play a starring role in San Andreas, but most of the movie wasn't shot in the Golden State, but rather an ocean away in Queensland, Australia. That's because the film's producers got a generous tax credit package from the Australian and Queensland governments. Since the 1990s, such production tax incentive packages, offered by both foreign countries and other states, have come to dominate decisions over where films and TV shows get shot.
Now, you know, most studios feel like they can't make a film unless they have a tax credit.
That's Chris Baugh, a successful Hollywood location manager who's worked on such films as The Italian Job and Argo. He says his job used to be about finding, say, the best mountain, river, or small town main street to film. Now, Baugh says, it's often about looking for the best tax incentive or rebate program, even if that means unexpectedly moving a production while it's being shot.
There was this movie, Transcendence, worked on a couple years back, and we set it up in Boston because of the rebate, and as that dried up, we closed down and we rescouted for another 3 months in New Mexico, and you know, I think we jumped to the rebate states about three or four times.
Over 30 states now offer tax credits to film and TV productions, all with the hope of luring Hollywood away from Hollywood. And in just 1 year, that cost California 47,000 jobs and over $400 million in lost tax revenue. That according to a report released last year by the Southern California Association of Governments. To fight that runaway production, California launched its own film and television incentive program in 2009, offering $100 million a year in tax credits to producers who were picked by a lottery. But other states matched and exceeded California's incentives. So legislation was passed and signed into law by Governor Brown last year. And now the state has started a new production tax credit program. It's much bigger, $330 million a year in tax credits versus $100 million. And unlike the old program, it allows big budget films and television shows to apply for the credits.
If you want to have a thriving entertainment production industry today, in 2015, you need a robust incentive program.
That's Amy Lemish, executive director of California's Film Commission, which runs the Production Tax Incentive Program. In Lemish's Hollywood Boulevard office, we talked about what the new program is supposed to accomplish.
What's going to be success to you and to the state of California because of this new program? What targets are you trying to hit?
The general level of production in California, that will be our success. When we see more levels of all types of productions, more of our crews finding work, and our support businesses, that there's thousands and thousands of small support businesses that the production use for services or rentals or specialty items, we hope to see those thrive.
But even as California expands its production incentive program, many economists and tax experts question the wisdom and effectiveness of such efforts.
When a state is like California is spending $300 million a year subsidizing film and television, you know, what other things could that $300 million be spent on? And when you evaluate it from that perspective, maybe you're not even getting any benefits at all.
Joe Henchman is a vice president at the Washington, D.C.-based Tax Foundation and has studied production tax credit programs across the country. He says as states have tried to outdo each other to attract and keep film and TV productions, they've become locked in a kind of tax incentive arms race.
15 years ago, states didn't really do this. Filming had to live or die by its ability to raise financing and earn profits. And all told, right now, states are subsidizing film and television production by about $1.5 billion a year.
Henchman also says economic benefits gained from increased film and TV production often don't match the revenue the states lose by offering tax breaks.
The added economic activity, the added tourism, the added restaurant visits, the added hotel stays, the added employment of part-time personnel, it does not come close to making up for the outlay of the subsidy to the production company.
Here in California, to ensure the economy is getting the most bang for the tax credit buck, films and TV shows will go through a competitive process. Instead of being selected by a lottery, productions will be ranked by how many jobs they create and dollars they spend to support other businesses. And the California Film Commission's Amy Lemish says her office will make sure film and TV makers are meeting their targets.
We have very stringent controls in place to monitor that what a production said they were going to do, they actually do. Did the production pay all their payroll? Did they pay all their bills? Did they spend what they said they were going to spend? And are the numbers penciling out?
Location manager Chris Baugh, who you met earlier, hopes California's new tax incentive program works. And on a personal note, he's also just tired of spending time on the road as movies are shot out of state just because of tax incentives.
Yeah, I've been spent so much time away from home, living in a hotel room, you know, that I've considered leaving the business so that I could just kind of pick my life back up the way I left it and continue on like a normal human being. You have to ask yourself, is it worth it? How badly do you want to work in the film industry? Because that's pretty tough.
But Baugh will soon be traveling again, heading out to scout locations in Georgia, a state known for its generous production tax incentives. For KCRW, I'm Saul Gonzalez.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.